So today I'm going to talk about methods that we're using to try to define asymptomatic women who are at risk for more severe infection. And the problem that we're focusing on is chlamydia. Now, as you've seen, chlamydia is a very common sexually transmitted bacterial infection, the leading bacterial STI in the world. 1 in 10 sexually active teenage girls are infected. And because there's a large percentage of asymptomatic girls, they oftentimes aren't detected unless they're screened and remain symptom-free. And reinfection is very common, also causing an increased prevalence of this infection. The problem is that these young women can sustain repeated or chronic infection, and this can lead to chronic pelvic pain. And you can see from our earlier speakers the very high rates, around 20 to 30% of chronic pelvic pain in women with chlamydia PID. They can also sustain subfertility and infertility, as well as ectopic pregnancy. As you heard from Harold Weisenfeld, although around 4 million young girls and women are diagnosed with chlamydial infection in this country every year, these are detected through testing, and around 10% of those in studies may develop PID. These are studies over a year. 10% of women with undetected chlamydial infection may develop PID. In shorter-term studies, it's around 5%. And then subsets of those women will go on to develop infertility, chronic pelvic pain, or tubal pregnancy. And these rates are all determined by women with PID. The question is, what about the 3,600,000 girls and young women with asymptomatic chlamydial infection? Can we determine among those women who are at higher risk for these long-term sequelae? So the question is, can we identify asymptomatic women at risk for sequelae with a minimally invasive test? So we sought to do this by through a cooperative research center that was funded by the NIH at the University of Pittsburgh. It involves recruitment of two cohorts of young women, women with acute PID that are participating in a clinical trial that is ran by Harold Weisenfeld, adding the benefit of anti-anaerobic therapy to standard therapy. And then there's another cohort that's a study that's conducted by me looking at high-risk women for chlamydia who don't have PID, and we're looking at T-cell responses among these women to try to determine vaccine antigens for chlamydial vaccine development. Many of these women have more than 3 sexual partners in the previous 6 months, less than 14 years of age sexual debut, mucopurulent cervicitis on exam, or are known to have a sexual contact with an infected partner. At enrollment, all of these women in both cohorts undergo cervical swab collection, and an endometrial biopsy is conducted by the clinical core that is directed by Harold, and blood is also obtained. The cervical swabs are examined for microbiology as well as the endometrial biopsy, and the endometrial biopsy is examined for histology to look for endometritis. In addition, RNA is obtained from the peripheral blood of these women, and microarray is performed with Illumina bead chip. This is Dr. Xiaojing Zhang as a geneticist and a biostatistician who has really been instrumental in driving this work forward. So Dr. Zhang came up with a data processing scheme to look at the RNA or the transcriptional profiles from these women. The data are normalized using quantiles, statistical filters are applied, and probes with low mean expression and a small standard deviation across all samples are removed. Group comparisons are done to identify differentially expressed genes among the groups. Multiple testing corrections are applied, and then finally, the gene expression data is validated through RT-PCR. When we developed a strategy for identifying chlamydia disease-specific genes, we initially thought, well, we'll look at women with chlamydia who have pelvic pain and PID, and those will be our cases, compare them to asymptomatic uninfected women. But that really just determines women with chlamydial infection. It doesn't really drive the analysis of disease-associated genes. So instead of this approach, we actually used women with chlamydial pain, chlamydial infection who had PID, they were in the anti-anaerobic clinical trial, and compared them with women who were enrolled to the T-cell study who were diagnosed with chlamydia only at their cervix and their endometrium was negative for infection, and these women did not have symptoms of PID. And we discovered the differentially expressed genes among these two groups. We clustered these genes and then examined women with chlamydia who had chlamydial infection diagnosed also in their endometrium, but who were asymptomatic and did not have symptoms of PID. And we also examined clustered women without chlamydia who didn't have PID as our negative controls. So these are our clustering based on the top 200 differentially expressed genes between women with chlamydia PID and women with chlamydia only at their cervix. And you can see that in 8 women with chlamydia PID, there's a clear clustering of the differentially expressed genes among those women. In women with chlamydia at their cervix who did not have PID, and women who were uninfected without PID, there's really a distinguishing clustering away from women with chlamydia PID. There were some women who had chlamydia at their endometrium who also were indistinguishable from healthy women or women with infection only at their cervix. But there were a subset of women who definitely clustered close to or very near women with chlamydia who had PID and established endometritis. So we can see from this early subset or cohort of women that transcriptional profiling of women with chlamydial infection indeed identified a chlamydial PID signature. The majority of women with asymptomatic chlamydial infection at the cervix tended to cluster with uninfected controls. But some women with endometrial chlamydial infection without symptomatic PID share transcriptional patterns with a CTPID group, raising the possibility that the CTPID signature could predict progression to disease. So subsequently, we have gathered an independent testing group of women. And Dr. Zhang basically used support vector methods to determine a predictive algorithm to try to predict women who we were blinded to find out if they would indeed had a high risk or high probability of having a signature that mirrored chlamydia PID. And you can see that 5 out of 5 women using this algorithm were predicted with a very high risk of greater than 80% to indeed have chlamydial PID. When we looked at women with endometrial chlamydial infection using this SVM-derived model, you can see that 1 of 9 women with endometrial chlamydial infection who had chronic endometritis had a higher probability of PID, 2 out of 21 with unknown histology, and then only 0 of 13 that were negative for endometritis but indeed had endometrial chlamydial infection. When we looked at women who had chlamydia determined only at their cervix, you can see that there was 1 out of 2 women who had acute endometritis with chlamydia at their cervix who clustered in the women with PID, and 1 out of 7 with cervical chlamydia infection and chronic endometritis. Of those with cervical infection and unknown histology, none clustered with PID group, and those with negative endometritis also did not cluster in the PID group. A group of uninfected asymptomatic women also had a low probability of having PID. So overall, 5 out of 90 of these asymptomatic women with chlamydial infection were predicted by this algorithm to have a high probability of developing chlamydial PID by SVM. And this rate actually mirrors what is seen in clinical epidemiologic studies. If you were using this algorithm perhaps to really screen women, the thought would be to actually lower the cutoff so that you wouldn't miss anyone that might have a risk of developing long-term complications. So next, we actually took our 200 differentially expressed genes and look to see or ask the question, is the chlamydial PID signature indeed pathogen-driven? So we selected additional patients from within the PID cohort in whom microbiological testing did not detect infection with a recognized STI pathogen. And indeed, when we clustered these according to women to the signature of women with chlamydia PID, you can see again that the women with chlamydia and PID clustered together. And those who did not have a diagnosed STI pathogen or known pathogen also tended to cluster away from the women with chlamydia, but together. We then looked at women with MGEN PID, given more and more data is indicative of MGEN's association with PID. And so we profiled transcripts from women with PID associated with Mycoplasma genitalium infection using the chlamydia PID signature. And indeed, we found that women with chlamydia PID were again clustered together and away from women with MGEN PID. However, there were subsets of genes that were similar in women with chlamydia PID and MGEN PID. And these were different than women who did not have an STI pathogen and did not have PID. When you use ingenuity pathway analysis, you can actually form networks to analyze the genes associated with the network driving the disease. And you can see that among women with chlamydia, there was a downregulation of genes associated with cell death and survival in their peripheral blood. There was an upregulation of genes associated with infection responses and inflammatory responses, not only in women with chlamydia, but also in those with MGEN, PID. And finally, interferon signaling pathways were only upregulated in women with chlamydia, which kind of supports all the animal data for years that shows that interferon signaling pathways are very important in chlamydial responses. So finally, our PID transcriptional networks have shown that microarray analysis of whole blood from women with PID definitely identifies STI pathogen-specific transcriptional networks. But signatures can also be identified that are not exclusive to the pathogen, but indeed identify women with infection-induced PID. It is our thought that these networks can be used to identify genes important in determining increased risk for disease. Finally, we feel that the benefits of identifying PID biomarkers are several-fold. For one, a biomarker that can be obtained from the blood would allow improved surveillance of at-risk individuals and targeted screening for those at highest risk. It would also identify the population most likely to benefit from a vaccine if one were to be developed and facilitate the recruitment of appropriate candidates for clinical trials. Finally, these biomarkers provide surrogate endpoint markers to evaluate novel therapies and vaccine candidates. I'd like to acknowledge the patients that UPMC submitted their blood and tissues for our study, and of course, Dr. Weisenfeld, who directs our STI-CRC clinical core, others in the core, and the genomics and proteomics cores at both the University of Pittsburgh and UNC who have helped us with these data, Dr. Zhang, who's been a real driving force in the genetic analysis, as well as others on my team, and of course our funding sources, and I'll end there. Thank you.
Thanks, everyone, for great presentations. We're going to take questions in a minute. Just a reminder that there are going to be lunches available at the poster session starting at 12 noon. So do we have any questions? If you could come up to the mic and maybe say who you want to ask the question to.
This question is for Dr. Trent. Can you talk about what the community health nurses do during their home visits and whether you think it could be done by someone who is not an RN, but say a public health advisor? Is it mainly a clinical check or is it patient teaching and assessment?
So she actually does the 72-hour visit, and we felt that having an RN level person at that minimum, and then there's to do that visit, she actually does train her to do an abdominal exam and everything. 25% of girls come back for their PID care, so the majority of them are missing that 72-hour follow-up that the CDC recommends. And so having her go out and do that, she has a specific algorithm. If she sees any of those things, then the patient has to be referred back in for care. And so it's really training some. I think the nurse is at the sort of lowest, I think, from a clinical perspective that we could go for that work. I will say that our young ladies do rely quite a bit on our DIS, our outreach worker. I think she is also a critical force in sort of getting them to come back in for their care for their other follow-up visits. So I do think there's a role for people who have another skill set in this kind of team, and I think together the nurse working, community health nurse working with that individual who's very community savvy really enhances our ability to track and follow these girls long term.
I have a question for Tony. Actually, I have two questions. One is, how early are these PID biomarkers expressed? And secondly, did you look at their presence in the co-infection with gonorrhea?
So how early are they expressed? So these women are women who are recruited into a clinical trial. So they're women who present with PID. They have pelvic pain for less than a month. To be included in the trial.
I guess my question has to do with clinical relevance. I guess if we're looking for an early biomarker to predict perhaps PID in these women.
Right. So our goal is really not to find the women with pain because those are obvious, but basically to be able to use the biomarker to predict women who are completely asymptomatic. So, and clearly some of those cluster with women. It appears that some women, when they come in and they're asymptomatic, if they weren't treated, then probably within a couple of weeks they would have developed PID. Because their blood, which is, it's pretty amazing to me that you can find this in the blood. I mean, I would have predicted we'd find it in the endometrium, but to find it in the blood, I was really quite surprised, pleasantly surprised. But we can clearly find women whose transcriptional profiles, and we've actually gotten it down to 44 genes. So with just 44 genes, we can find a group of women, a subset, who are completely asymptomatic, who have chlamydial infection, but their profile really mirrors women with pain and diagnosed endometritis. And so that is the ultimate goal, will be to find the 5% out there and be able to say, not only do you have chlamydia, but your blood transcriptional profile suggests that you're at very high risk for long-term complications. So you definitely need to be screened. You definitely need to use protection. And, we need to see you more often, really kind of accelerate targeted screening in that respect.
And my second question had to do with the presence of these biomarkers
in GC. So unfortunately, we our GC population are, well, it's good that we don't have much GC in Pittsburgh. So although I will say that they do kind of come in spurts when school lets out or school starts up, various things. And so our hope is that once Harold has recruited the entire cohort of individuals and our study is complete, that we will have sufficient number of women with GC only to be able to determine their look at their blood profile as well. Yeah, we do have a lot of MGen, as you're seeing in Maria's study as well. And also I have to state that I showed you our training set and our test set, and thanks to Maria's TechN trial, she's actually sending us blood that we are blinded to their infection status, but these are all women, girls with PID, so that now we can hopefully validate our profile of genes in another young set of women.
My name is Jonathan Ross from Birmingham, the UK. A question for Harold Weidenfeld. You highlight very clearly how many patients, women who have partly uncomplicated chlamydia, actually have clinical endometritis and a low level PID, and that's bad for them. What does that mean in clinical practice, though? Because we can't do any biopsies, look back, find out who the women are. To change our treatment for these women?
That's a great question, Jonathan. We did actually finish a treatment trial. The data is actually in analysis right now, so I can't divulge what we're finding. But the question is treatment different or not in these women with subclinical PID as opposed to seemingly uncomplicated cervicitis? I guess we'll have to stay tuned to the next meeting. Perhaps I can present it at that time. It's also possible that the damage was already done, by the time that we see them. And I think that the epidemiologic data about the tubal factor infertility from Karen Hoover's work and the ectopic pregnancy persistence may reflect that, interrupting the disease at the acute PID level is not where it needs to be. It needs to be prior to any ascension of organisms. And maybe Tony's work, as she alluded to so eloquently, about trying to identify who would be at risk for developing upper tract inflammation would be key.
So tantalizing. Thank you.
Thanks.
Hi, this is a question for Dr. Darville. I'm really excited about the work you've been doing on biomarkers. I think this is really important. And one of my questions is I know you're looking at chlamydia vaccines and how, I'm curious how the transcriptional assays, how that translates into the kind of antigens that have been identified as possible targets for chlamydia vaccines.
Okay. In the cervicitis cohort, we had the luxury of working with a vaccine company called Genosha Biosciences, who really have a unique assay that is where they look at the entire chlamydial orpheum. So each gene is expressed, and we can look to see women in our study, what proteins among the chlamydial ORFs that they responded to. And fortunately, with the clinical core, they're wonderful at getting these women back in. We have an 85% follow-up rate out to a year. And so we see these women at 1 month, 4 months, 8 months, and 12 months. And so we've been able to categorize women into those who get repeated infection over time, and also a subset who are still highly exposed but not acquiring repeated infection. And so when we look at those, we can look to see what proteins are women responding to in those individual groups. And it's clearly a different set of proteins. And they're not immunodominant proteins. So it appears that certain antigens drive a protective response. And so there's proteins that are highly frequently recognized in our protected women. And those we're considering as candidate vaccine antigens. What's even further interesting is that we now have looked at the blood transcriptional responses of these women. And they clearly also fall out different. And that the women who develop a protected response and don't sustain reinfection over time have a different transcriptional response profile than women who do sustain repeated infection over time. So it kind of all fits together.
This is Lisa Manhart from the University of Washington, and I have a question for Harold. And obviously my question, of course, is about M. genitalium.
Wow. Shocked. Right. Shocking, shocking.
But I was actually very interested to see your results showing that subclinical PID was so strongly related with infertility. And I was wondering if you had had an opportunity to, if you had enough women with M. genitalium that you were able to look at what kind of relationship there was with M. genitalium infection and subclinical PID.
So it is related as well. We haven't published it yet, but it is related that there is a relationship between independent relationship between mycoplasma genitalium and endometritis, which is consistent with your theory, which is good.
And with infertility?
With infertility, we haven't looked at that specifically, independently as an associative factor in the development of infertility. So, yeah, yeah.
Keith Radcliffe from Birmingham in the UK. Question for Dr. Weisenfeld. Finding associating BV with endometritis seems extremely important to me, given that BV is much commoner than chlamydia, gonorrhea, or mycoplasma, and of course frequently recurs. Were these all symptomatic women? Have you done the same thing for women who are asymptomatic, with people who had BV flora? Is that associated with endometritis?
So these are both symptomatic and asymptomatic women. The inclusion criteria for our subclinical PID studies was a known chlamydial gonococcal infection, so gonococcal or chlamydial cervicitis based on testing, or a symptomatic woman for bacterial vaginosis, or women who came in as contacts to men with chlamydia gonorrhea or non-gonococcal urethritis. So some of those women who were STD negative from that cohort could have been BV positive and asymptomatic and put in the trial. The majority of our women at the STD clinic who have bacterial vaginosis are symptomatic in some regard.
I'm Joan Chow from the California Department of Public Health. Thanks for a great panel. This is a question actually for all of you. And what we've seen is with our Kaiser patients who are diagnosed with symptomatic PID, there's a very, very different distribution for chlamydia and gonorrhea in the adolescents compared to the older women. And I'm using 25 years as the cutoff. And my question is, do you see a different distribution in terms of the relative role of chlamydia and gonorrhea versus anaerobes in younger women versus older women, suggesting that there might be some different etiologies and pathogenetic mechanisms for PID in younger women versus older women, and the difference between subclinical versus clinical in terms of the expression of and role of, you know, anaerobes versus chlamydia and gonorrhea.
So one of the lessons we have learned with the U19 NIH-funded study is that gonorrhea and chlamydia are certainly not as common as we had thought. We had inklings of that from the PEACH data, which showed that only 40% of women were infected with chlamydia and gonorrhea, and our rates are probably a tad lower than that now. We haven't stratified it by age, as you're pointing out, but certainly we're recognizing that most PID nowadays, or at least most clinically diagnosed PID in emergency rooms and in ambulatory centers, are probably not chlamydial or gonococcal. in etiology. It's probably what you're saying. I don't know if that's what you're seeing in your Kaiser population, but
yeah, that's much more chlamydia and gonorrhea in the younger PID cases,
right,
compared to the older ones. So
right.
It makes us wonder what's going on with the older women.
Right.
Marsha House from the University of North Carolina. I seem to remember, Harold, that in an earlier presentation from your data, very early actually, that Trichomonas popped up as an important player in PID in a way that was maybe akin to what BV is doing. And I hear nothing about Trichomonas anymore in your.
I thought that debate was over yesterday. I thought we were done with that. It may be a little bit additive, but nothing new. Nothing new on that, no.
I
wouldn't count. Good morning. My name is Miguel Tilly from Argentina, Buenos Aires. In the biomolecular era, I want to rescue the role of the inflammatory response in vagina to rule out the diagnosis of asymptomatic PID. What do you think?
So we looked at it. We looked at very crudely, I guess, inflammatory markers by vaginal PMNs, cervical PMNs, and there is an association. In other words, more PMNs in the lower genital tract correlates with endometritis, but it's neither sensitive nor specific. So from a clinical utility standpoint, it's really not that reliable.
Because we looked at include in the criteria for
right.
PID in base of a Sharon et al. Finding their response, the inflammatory response in
right.
the vagina.
Correct. An abundance of PMNs in the vagina would be suggestive of. It would be one of the other criteria that you may want to look at. I think from a clinical standpoint, how we use PMNs is that if we don't see PMNs in the vagina, then that usually rules out pelvic inflammatory disease in a woman who has pelvic pain. We also looked at defensins. This is a long time ago. I have to probe my brain as to the data on defensins that we published a long time ago. Defensins are products as a result of activation of neutrophils, and we did see, similar to what you had commented on, Doctor, that defensins were neutrophil defensins were elevated in women with subclinical PID with endometritis. Again, not at a point where the performance of that test would influence clinical management, though.
Another thing is in presence of bacterial vaginosis with inflammatory response, we have to think in pelvic inflammatory disease asymptomatic.
I think that's a good, a valid point, yes. Perhaps. Lots of reasons why there are PMNs in the vagina, though PID may be only one of them. So,
any final questions? Hearing none, we really want to thank our speakers for great presentations and your attendance.